Good morning. Welcome to the Oregon Zero Suicide Podcast Series. I'm Dr. Susan Keyes, and today I'm with Dr. Laura Penavaria, Chief Medical Officer for the St. Charles Medical Group. As we all know, leadership is a critical component for zero suicide. The type of changes needed will not happen without leadership buy-in. It's key. Yet, leadership is about more than saying yes to an innovation. Today, we're going to dive deeper and discuss more about what saying yes to zero suicide entails. But before we begin, Laura, would you please introduce yourself and tell our audience a little bit more about you and your background?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Susan. And thank you for having me for this Zero Suicide podcast. I'm a family doctor. I am from Southern California and went to college there, med school residency. I trained there. I practiced there for 10 years before moving to Central Oregon about 7 years ago. And in that time, I've become interested in suicide prevention and quite active in suicide prevention work. Currently, I have a very small practice. I see patients one day a week, but or actually a half day a week. But most of my time is spent on administrative duties and leading this medical group, which is about just shy of 300 providers.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about how you became more involved with suicide prevention. And I think it was even before you were with St. Charles.
Oh, that's correct. Yes. So I actually, where I was working at the time was nearby one of the high schools. My clinic was close to one of the high schools. And one snowy winter morning, I was sitting actually at my computer, and I had a very large window that I was looking out of on one of the main streets, and I just saw police cars whizzing by, and I thought something's going on. And something was going on, in fact, at the high school, and it actually was initially billed as an active shooter, so there was a lot of hype about it. It actually was a child who took his life at school. And so because it was initially thought to be an active shooter, the community was very aware of it very quickly, and it ended up being quite sensationalized in the press. And we ended up having a huge uptick in our clinic, and I was a medical director there at the time. We had a huge uptick in suicidal ideation and patients presenting with suicidal thoughts and, you know, calling the clinic with suicidal thoughts and patients that even in the midst of an ordinary visit would start talking about their suicidal thoughts. And it felt like a giant hot potato. I thought, I am not equipped to manage this. I don't know how to talk to these patients. I don't know what to recommend to them. It was kind of a challenging time. So that's when I started learning a little bit more about suicide prevention. In part, you know, I ran into you, of course, you know, as you know, Susan and Jessica Jacks from Deschutes County Public Health. And I just said, hey, can you guys help me? I have this situation and I don't know how to help these people. And you and Jessica were both so gracious and so helpful. And I learned so much about just suicidal thinking and suicidal behavior and what works and what doesn't work for suicide prevention. But the thing that I learned around that time that was the most striking was that the vast majority of patients that die by suicide have had contact with their primary care provider. I've seen their primary care provider in the year preceding their death. And in fact, 45% of people who die by suicide have seen their primary care provider in the month preceding their death. And when I learned that, that was kind of a pivotal moment for me. It was when I recognized this as a moral obligation. That we as primary care providers needed to take this on as our responsibility, you know, and we couldn't just say, you know, this is the purview of behavioral health, or this is an emergency, all these people need to go to the ER or anything like that. I said, well, we don't know how to do that, but we need to figure out how to do this.
And that was before you were with St. Charles.
Correct, yes.
And as I recall, you started to get the clinic,
yes,
where you were working,
right,
interested and involved.
Yes.
And your leadership even extended beyond that, mm-hmm, to the newly formed Central Oregon Suicide Prevention Coalition. And what were some of the things that you kind of took on and helped shape through that alliance?
Yeah, so what I did was I just said, well, I'm not going to be able to figure this out by myself. And I also am going to need, you know, people present for primary care to many organizations in our community. And so I outreached to all of those organizations to say, hey, is there somebody that you could send to this group I'm forming? We can all kind of talk, research, figure out what we can do about this problem, and move forward. And we had some enthusiastic support at the start. We had people from a variety of organizations in the community, and it ended up being an independent body, not associated with any particular organization, but it is, we were comprised, this primary care suicide prevention work group is comprised of individuals from several different organizations. And we've kind of settled into this core group of us that does the bulk of the work, but that kind of flexes, the size of the group flexes a little bit. Whenever we have a suicide in our community, we get a lot more interest in people wanting to help out, wanting to be part of the solution, which is great, and we kind of leverage that when we can. But it really did start out as a joint effort by a lot of folks in a variety of organizations.
And that group was instrumental in putting together a toolkit.
Correct.
For primary care providers.
Yes.
You just kind of tell us what that's about and how that came about?
Well, we really wanted it to be that there was no wrong door. If someone had suicidal thoughts, that they could call the call center and the person would know what to do. The receptionist would know what to do, the MA, the nurse, the provider, everyone in the clinic. And so we developed workflows for all of those folks of kind of what to do. We adopted a safety planning worksheet that we're using. And Barbara Stanley.
Yeah.
I was blanking on her name for a minute there. Barbara Stanley's work, that we kind of adopted that and started talking about, well, let's talk about how we can actually, now that we are getting towards where we can address this, how do we actually uncover it? Because you're not going to know if you don't ask the question. Mm-hmm. And I've been surprised at the answer at times. That people that you're not thinking that might be having suicidal thoughts are actually having those thoughts. So gaining comfort with that question is a big thing. And then when you're confident in your clinic workflows, you can start screening, universal screening for suicidal ideation. So that's kind of where we've gotten with that.
So if as I'm sort of hearing your evolution in, mm-hmm, this, you went from a really critical moment in our local community.
Correct.
Saw huge needs emerge.
Yes.
Reached out to other leaders,
mm-hmm,
and said, we have a problem to be solved.
Mm-hmm.
And you really built some very interesting infrastructure that other clinics, other groups, other providers could take advantage of.
Correct. Yes.
And then, just knowing you, mm-hmm, I know you've kind of shifted your roles, mm-hmm, from being the medical director at a clinic, mm-hmm, and much more hands-on with patients,
mm-hmm,
to now this leadership role in a much larger, more complex group.
Correct.
And I imagine that you're bringing that same commitment to this position, but it might play out a little differently because of its complexity. Can you just chat about that a bit?
Yes, that's an excellent insight, Susan, and it's so true. You know, it's funny. I think it's that old adage, little kids, little problems, big kids, big problems, you know. it's similar to clinic management or medical management. Little clinics, little problems, big organization, big, you know, bigger challenges. So you're absolutely right. I think that it's if you're just talking about one clinic or a handful of clinics, and just primary care, and you know, it you're a lot more nimble if you're trying to change workflows and do things. But we're attempting to take on zero suicide in our large organization, which is a health system, four hospitals, 300 providers, 28 specialties. It's big, and so the challenges are we have a variety of challenges with it. First is my first initial hurdle when I was thinking about implementing zero suicide here was of course, first you have to get executive leadership buy-in, which we have because I'm on the executive team, and then also spoke with the CEO of our organization about it, and he bought in, and which was awesome, because that's a critical component of zero suicide is leadership buy-in. But then the biggest hurdle, I think, has been training and how to get folks educated, because there's a lot of misinformation out there about suicide and about talking about suicide, and so while you want people to address the topic and talk to people about potentially their suicidal thoughts, you also want them to do so in a way that is evidence based and is not going to cause harm to the person. The other hand, people are often too hesitant, thinking that they're going to plant the idea in someone's head if they talk to them about suicide. And so there's a lot of education that needs to take place. And when you've got a workforce of 4,000 employees, to have all of those people go to a class is difficult to achieve. Mm-hmm. So we've kind of we've had quite a lot of QPR training internally, but it hasn't been done in a very systematic fashion. So that we're planning how the training gets rolled out is a big hurdle, is kind of the big plan. And it's really the biggest expense is doing that training as well, because you have to pay staff for their time. You have to pay other staff to cover for them, you know, so you're double paying people plus the cost of the class. It's a lot of expense. And when that comes in a time of economic difficulty for, you know, healthcare in general in the United States, it doesn't, that training becomes deprioritized, unfortunately, in the face of other competing priorities of the health system. So that's kind of been
That's a big hurdle for you.
It really is. But we're kind of working through it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things that I think I hear a commitment to is that suicide prevention, to be comprehensive, it's not just training the provider.
That's correct.
And you had done all of that really good work through the primary care work group around workflows for people in different roles.
Right.
And that takes time to then think about how you train all of those different levels of people.
Mm-hmm. One of the biggest, I think, temptations with work with suicide prevention is to just get it done now. There's this sense of urgency for people that are in the field and doing this work. Every time there's another suicide, there's just, we have to prevent the next one. There's just this sense of, oh my gosh, we have to get on this. And yet this is a problem that is, I would say, it's particularly recalcitrant. It's difficult to address. It's difficult to get to. And it takes time. It takes a lot of teaching. It takes a lot of education of folks. engagement of people. It's the kind of work that can't be just pushed out in an email. It's not something that can happen quickly. So
I think that's a really good point. And I would imagine that there's teaching and then mentoring.
Correct.
And supervising.
Yes.
And making sure that there's the transition from I've learned this to I practice this.
Yes, absolutely.
And making sure that things are being done the way they're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that takes time to put all of those pieces into place.
Yes, it does.
Staff are a critical part. We've talked about that, and you've talked about the different roles that people play. Can you tell us how your staff was introduced to this idea and just even where you are in that process? Because you said you have over 4,000 people.
Right.
That's a huge undertaking.
Right. Yeah. Well, we went to the Zero Suicide Academy a couple months before, I think maybe a month or two before we had an EHR implementation here, which for health systems, changing your EHR is a rather large event akin to getting married or something like that. It's very, very big. And so there's a lot of reverberation from that. And so that kind of put a hitch in our process a little bit. It caused us to kind of get off to a slow start.
So just to clarify, it wasn't a change in the EHR to integrate Zero Suicide.
No.
It was a change in
EHR.
Exactly.
an entirely new EHR. And so, so it was a big deal. And we're still still settling into that. But Zero Suicide is also a fairly big initiative. And so just introducing it has been, I don't know how to describe it. It hasn't been as systematic as mm-hmm. I would have liked it to be. It's a little bit of fits and starts right now in the work.
And I think just so our audience knows, Laura said that they attended the Zero Suicide Academy and then began to think about how they might roll this initiative out. That was about 6 months ago.
It wasn't okay. Yeah.
So it wasn't that long ago.
I see.
And
it feels like it was very long. It feels like, oh my gosh, why don't we have this solved? That's back to that sense of urgency that I was talking about. You just feel like we need to get this done mm-hmm. for once and for all. And this is just, it's a problem that is going to be with us and that we need to manage and we need to, you know, care for this problem and the solution to it.
And when you think about it and the kinds of things that you've described, it's not a been there, done that, finished.
No,
that's
right.
It's a dynamic process. Mm-hmm. There are always new people to be trained. There are new adjustments to make in what you're doing.
So true.
It's just an ongoing process, which can cause some fatigue.
It can.
Have you thought about that at all? Just fatigue with doing new
for me or for the organization?
For the organization.
Oh yes, sure,
sure.
Oh yeah. Change fatigue is a real thing, you know. And when you're in a large organization and healthcare systems in general end up having a lot of kind of executive turnover, and when you talk to people that have been with St. Charles for 25 years or something, they say, well, you know, executives turn over, new initiatives get introduced, and then they fizzle out over time. Not everything does, but certain things do. And so I'm wanting to be careful and deliberate in introducing it so that that people don't see this as something that we're going to lose commitment for mm-hmm. or lose interest in.
And you really want it to take root.
Absolutely. I really want it to be the fabric, a part of the fabric of St. Charles.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that I wanted to ask you about, we had a conversation at the Zero Suicide Academy.
Yes.
About the impact on staff if a patient is lost.
Yes.
Or dies by suicide.
Yes.
And we talked about the concept of helping staff understand maybe the difference between being accountable versus being responsible. Yes. And I was kind of intrigued by that. And I wondered if you could just share some thoughts about that.
Sure. Yeah. You know, when someone dies by suicide, you know, the folks that are left behind are always left thinking, what could I have done differently? What did I miss? What didn't I do? Did I make the right decision? Did I make the right choice? Why didn't I see this? I mean, they second guess every thought and action that they have. And the medical staff is no different for that. When you lose a patient, or whether it's the doctor or the MA in the clinic or the nurse at the bedside or whoever it is, they're always going to have those thoughts. And I think that you have to kind of, as we say, we are about zero suicide, and we're going to take accountability for this problem, and we are going to own this problem and the solution to this problem. That doesn't make us responsible for the suicide, but we are accountable to do everything that we can to prevent suicide and to learn from each suicide to the extent that we can. In a way that is compassionate to the individuals that are going through that hard time, you know, with having lost someone. You know, there's a way to kind of talk about it without assigning blame to anyone, blame to anyone else or to yourself, mm-hmm. and saying, you know, what can we learn from this that we can apply to future situations so that we can maintain our accountability.
So it's really looking at ourselves as an organization, mm-hmm. ourselves as a system. Mm-hmm. Was there something that we could have done better?
Right.
Again, this dynamic process, was right. there something that we should adjust or something that we should change?
That's right. But if you allow staff to be out there, hanging out there, feeling like this sense of responsibility or guilt over the suicide, and don't address that, they are going to shy away from being involved in suicide prevention, because that's an awful feeling to mm-hmm. feel that you're in some way responsible for someone else's suffering or death. Mm-hmm. If you can't alleviate that, it's going to impede your progress too.
Good. Well, thank you. I think that's just a really interesting and helpful perspective. So as we think about kind of your journey and now kind of your hopes for this organization that you have a leadership role in, mm-hmm. as you kind of think about that, what advice might you give for others who are in your situation, who are about to launch this major initiative? And advice would you give them?
I would say be patient and tenacious. It's really a lot like research. You have months of boredom punctuated by highly exciting findings. You know, every once in a while you'll get a victory or you'll get something implemented and the staff is engaged and something's going right. And then you have months of like, I can't get these people into a meeting. I can't get this to take off the ground. Oh, we're going to have to back burner that. And this, you know, it's all of the kind of things that you need to kind of just walk through, be patient, but hang on, because you'll get to those victories.
Good. Mm-hmm. Good advice. be tenacious and patient.
Yes.
Good advice. Anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
Well, I just want to thank everyone that's listening for being part of the solution and for your commitment to suicide prevention in your community, and just encourage people to keep fighting the good fight.
Well, that's good advice, and thank you very much. That concludes this episode of our Oregon Zero Suicide podcast. Thank you for being a listener.